So 3, 2, 1. Hey again, everybody. So Steve Jr. and Steve Sr. here for the second installment of our podcast. And today we're going to focus on some historic drum shops, kind of the inspiration for our shop and, you know, all other shops of
and
today.
And specifically for New York City, the historic independent shops that existed in New York City. That's what we'll focus on today. And in tribute to that, historic drum shops and historic drums. So today I decided to put my matching pink champagne sparkle wood Dynasonic on the table as part of the eye candy for today. It's not for sale, so don't ask. It goes with my personal Rogers kit back there. But since we're talking about vintage drum shops, we might as well have a vintage drum there too.
Very cool, very rare drum. So first off, I just want to say check us out at maxwelldrums.com. We're gonna have a brand new website really soon. Whenever you're listening to this, we probably already have our new site up, so scope that out. And then our Reverb store, Steve Maxwell Drums-Chicago, Steve Maxwell Drums-New York. We got Instagrams, Maxwell Drum Shop Chicagoland, and then at Maxwell Drum Shop. That's basically the New York one. And then there's also Twitter, at Maxwell Drum Shop. Easy to remember. All right, so let's get started. So tell me about Manny's Music in New York. This is our first New York music shop that we're going to focus on.
Yes, Manny's was the place to go in New York City. And you have to keep in mind, we're talking about, especially in the 50s and into the 60s, number one, again, no internet, no online anything, no big box stores like there are today. If you wanted musical instruments, you went into an independent store. Either they were full-line music stores, or they were drum stores. Some were just guitar stores. And in New York City, 48th Street, right around 7th Avenue, was basically called Music Row, because you had tons of music dealers there. And it was a great place. Manny's Music was basically the place that everyone went to. So if you look at the jazz scene in New York City in the 50s, There was music everywhere, and everybody who came through town would go over to Manny's. That's where all the drummers would hang. They would go to get their stuff. So Manny's was the place, the first place that actually became a conversation point, a center of activity for drummers in New York City. And over the course of time, now Manny's, by the time I was going to New York City, Manny's had become part of Sam Ash, basically. Manny's was still there, but eventually got absorbed by Sam Ash Music. So Manny's went away. But in the early 70s...
You're talking way before the shop started. What decade are you talking?
When I used to go in the 70s, Manny's was still there. But over the course of time, much, much later on, Manny's got absorbed by Sam Ash. And Manny's did not exist any longer. But... you know, Manny's was one of those great places to go. It was one of the true independent shops. Sam Ash Music, which eventually absorbed Manny's, is another for a smaller shop, but they're actually more of a, not a big box, but they're more of a multi-chain retailer. So I don't really kind of count Sam Ash in this conversation as one of the, one of the smaller independent shops. But it's important to mention them because they absorb Manny's.
Yeah, I remember. When I used to go to the shop, there was the Sam Ash, and then on the pavement as you walked in, there would be the Manny's Music, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, it was actually Manny's was across the street from Sam Ash. So what ended up happening was, for a while after Sam Ash bought Manny's, it was still operating, but it was really Sam Ash, and then they eventually closed that down, and it all absorbed within Sam Ash, and that whole side of the street, the buildings are gone now.
We were there at kind of the end of the era for that Music Row.
We were. And actually, one quick funny story. There was a big sign, huge, I mean, it was like 40 feet tall, that said Manny's Music outside the building.
I think maybe I remember that.
And
yeah.
when this all happened several years ago now, when they took that whole side of the street down to build condos, unfortunately.
That's what we need more of.
That sign was there, and somebody said, "Why don't you take it?" And I said, "What am I going to do with the sign?" It's 40 feet tall. I mean, I'd love to have it as a piece of history, but what am I going to do with a 40-foot tall sign?
I
don't even know how to move it. Anyway, enough for that. But
someone probably took it.
I hope so. I don't know what happened to it. I hope it didn't get trashed. But But Manny's was the first place. That was the first place.
Cool story. So we're going to go to some other shops now. This is maybe the most iconic New York drum shop, Frank Ippolito's. And I've heard many, many a story from this shop, but why don't you?
Yeah. Frank Ippolito's Pro Percussion was a great place. And I started going there. I used to live in Rhode Island, and I would take the bus. It was a four-hour bus trip. I'd take the bus into New York City. I'd stay at the President Hotel, which actually is still there today. And it was actually a really cheap, crappy hotel when I used to stay there. But it's actually a really nice place now. It's been renovated a bunch of times, and it's really great. But I didn't have much money. I was, I don't know, 18 years old. And I would go there, and I would stay there, and I would go hang at Frank Ippolito's. And Frank's place was great. They had Frank himself ran the business. He had help from a woman who ran the office. Her name was Kathy. She was a great person. Joe Gallivan was a guy at Frank's shop, and Joe was a character. He was a good player, great player, but he was also a quasi-inventor, and he actually invented the first electronic drum that eventually became a Moog drum. And what he did was he simply had a little 6-inch bongo and a little device under the head, and you would strike it with a mallet. Now, again, this sounds like, well, what's the big deal? Well, this was 1970, whatever, one, two, when none of this existed. And so you take a soft mallet like a timpani mallet, and the harder you hit, the higher the pitch. And if you hit it softly, the pitch was low. And that was all it did.
That's
so, I mean,
cool.
Just think about it. It ran into an amplifier, and, you know, that was all it did.
So it's kind of similar to those, like, Hollywood drums, like, in the way it looked? Or did it, like...
No, I mean, Hollywood drums were a whole different thing out of Italy.
That was
a little more bizarre. And that was just an electronic drum. A Hollywood drum supposedly had three different sounds if you press a different button with little envelope filters.
Yeah, a box that...
Didn't really work.
Yeah.
But this was different because this was a touch-sensitive membrane.
Yeah.
So... The lighter that you struck, the lower the pitch. The harder you struck, the higher the pitch. So you could, if you were adept at it, you could play musical interludes on it. It was pretty interesting. So Joe, I think eventually Joe sold that, and that became the Moog drum.
Yeah, but, in the listing, I'll probably include in there a couple links. There are some really awesome videos from that shop.
Yeah.
Of just kind of day-to-day activities, some stuff with Papa Joe, teaching lessons.
That was where I studied with Papa Joe, where we had our sessions, as he called them, not lessons. And that is also where I ran into Al Duffy. And Al Duffy was really, truly the first custom drum builder. Al, I used to pepper him endlessly with questions. And I always remember he was very patient, but I was a royal pain in the rear because I would bug him endlessly. Well, tell me about this. Tell me about that. And Al would bring in, at the time, he would build custom drums. And he brought in the shells. He, at the time, was buying Slingerland shells because he really liked the Slingerland shells for different projects. And then they were just raw shells. They would mount whatever hardware someone mounted on the drums. And I remember he had built a set once that was going out to a drummer who was playing with Diana Ross and the Supremes at the time. I don't remember who the drummer was. But the set was a beautiful walnut-stained set, and he had gone and gotten all the hardware 24-karat gold-plated. It was was insane beyond belief.
Was it Slingerland hardware? Or?
I don't remember what the hardware was at this time, but it was just a beautiful set. And Al used to also make drums for Billy Cobham.
Yeah.
And there's a snare drum that Billy Cobham uses on his Crosswinds album, and it's one of the sickest snare drums I've ever heard in my life, and it's one of the ones that Al made for him. I'd like to buy that drum from Billy one day. Anyway.
Very cool.
but that shop was an inspiration because that's where everyone would come. And if you keep in mind, if you think about today, when you buy cymbals, if you want the most expensive cymbals out there today are K Istanbuls, right? Well, back at this point in time, K Istanbuls really weren't vintage yet. They were just used cymbals. As same thing with Round Badge era Gretsch drums. 12, 14, 18, it was just a used drum set in the early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, those kits weren't hugely priced. And you could still get K-Istanbul cymbals were still being brought into the country for many years, distributed by Gretsch. So once in a while, a batch of new K-Istanbuls would come in, and I remember Frank Ippolito would say, we pick up the phone and we'd call everybody in town, and then within a few minutes, Elvin's over there, Mel Lewis is over there, Philly Joe's over there, whoever's in town over, pouring through the new K-Istanbuls to pull out their favorite stuff.
Looking for the good ones.
Yeah. So that place was iconic. I remember it really, really well. It had a lasting impression on me, and it was one of the things that always inspired me when we opened our shop in New York. It was a tribute. In New York City, our shop is a tribute to what Frank Ippolito's place was, and many other places in other areas, but in New York City, it's a real tribute to what Frank Ippolito's place was. So that was a great shop. I went there for many years, and then when I was no longer in the area, I hadn't been back there for a long time. Eventually, the shop changed hands after Frank died. His wife ran it for a little while, and then they closed after a while. But I have fond memories of that shop.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, I've heard many of these stories. And yeah, yes, it's always interesting. I wish I could have visited there.
It was a great place.
If we ever build a time machine, then maybe, can you just imagine looking through a brand new, you know, what did they have? Maybe like 50 old, you know, new Ks at that point?
Yeah, it was no big deal. It was just like a batch of cymbals came in today.
Yeah.
And today we'd be going 2,000, 2,200, 2,400, 2,600
back then they were
piece.
Like 100 bucks
probably,
maybe. Even with inflation, that's
they
nothing.
They were probably 150 bucks. I don't know. Yeah, yeah, it was
they
nothing.
Were more than the A's, but not much
more,
I think.
But not much.
Very cool. So, ready to move on to the next shop. So we got Modern Drum Shop, which was Joe Cusatis' place.
Yeah, Joe was great. When I went to New York, I have a great story about Joe, because I went to study with Joe, and by that time I was a pretty good player. I kind of knew what I was doing, and so I went to see Joe because I knew he was such a fabulous player. He used to play with the Peter Nero Trio, but he was a fabulous drummer. He had great taste, great style.
Where was this shop located?
In New York City. It was Midtown. I think he was around.
So he was in Manhattan.
He was in Manhattan. Oh, yeah. He was
and
around.
Frank Ippolito's.
Frank's in Midtown, 8th Avenue and 51st Street.
For whatever
And Modern Drum Shop was also right there in Midtown around, I think they were around 30th.
Cool.
But Joe, I went to study with Joe, and I really admired his playing. He was such a good, tasty player, but he still had plenty of reserve power. So I went to play for Joe, and I played, and I felt I did a pretty good job. And Joe's kind of an interesting character. He had an interesting, he would just tell you outright if he thought you were BSing him. But so Joe said, okay, it's fine, it's good. He said, do this. And for those of you that know what I'm doing, he said, play alternating strokes between your right hand and your right foot. And I immediately went into spastic because I couldn't do it because I had never worked on that. So the interesting thing about that, it wasn't Joe just showing off, but Joe looked at what I did and he said, okay, he could tell by looking. He says, this guy can do X and Y and Z, but he needs this over here because he's missing this piece of independence to help round out your playing. So it was, again, it wasn't, Joe had great chops, but it wasn't just chops for chops' sake. You know, it was all these things. If you learned how to do everything properly, and if you had great coordination here, but you didn't have right hand, right foot coordination, you were missing a piece of the whole puzzle, so he helped you dial that in. So he was a really, really good teacher in that respect. He could zero right in and know what you needed and what you needed to do to make that happen. So I give him credit for that. And then you fast forward a huge number of years to 2008 when we decided to open our store in New York City. Joe was still there running his shop, Modern Drum Shop. He was still there. And I remember talking to Joe before we opened up. And Joe said, I'm glad you're here, because he said, I'm 75 now. And he said, I don't want to, his lease was just coming to an end. He said, I don't want to sign up for 5 more years. Plus, the rents are crazy in New York City and everything else. So he literally closed his shop about, a month or so after we opened ours in 2008. And Joe is still alive today, which is great. And he had moved to, I think, Ohio at one point because his wife had family there. And then I think his wife passed, and I think he's now living in Florida near one of his children. So Joe was great, and we all owe Joe a lot. And sometime you get on and go watch a little bit of Joe Cusatis. Watch some of his playing. The guy was really masterful.
Very nice. Yeah, sounds like a really good educator.
He was. Very good.
People like that are great. Yeah, they can, you know, find those little things.
Yeah.
Like independence exercises. It's funny how sometimes I've been working on trying to do a left foot clave.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like I have so much independence in other areas, but that's just so challenging if you haven't really practiced it. Yeah.
And you got to give people credit. They're a good enough teacher where they can see you do a little bit and they go, all right, you got that, but what about this?
Sure.
And that is what rounds it out.
Hey, so you've never learned everything.
No.
Once you decide that you've learned everything, that's
forget it.
Probably yeah. When...
every day. I keep working on everything every day.
Yeah. We're busy today in the shop. that's a good thing.
Nothing wrong with that.
Got all kinds of people coming through, lathing cymbals, all kinds of stuff. We'll probably do a podcast on lathing cymbals at some point.
Yes, we should.
That'd
we
be
should.
Fun.
Yep.
We can show some examples.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That one, you would probably interview me.
That's right. Exactly. Because I don't know anything about it.
Well, a little bit, but... And me and Noah. Noah's doing a good job. So, yeah, on to the next shop, Drummer's World, which was the shop of Barry Greenspan.
Yep. Barry was in New York City for a long, long time, and nice guy. And he had a shop that it was a great independent shop, again. And Barry had a interesting kind of specialty, though. He did a lot of rental of gear to the Broadway shows, which... was great and very lucrative for him, which was good. And Barry also had a specialty in various types of world percussion instruments. So, myself, I am not, I have an appreciation for it, of course, but I don't have knowledge and expertise in world percussion. So, I used to go over to Barry's, and Barry was still in New York City when we opened our shop in 2008. He was still there. And at that point in time, most of Barry's rental work for Broadway had, things had changed there, because what started to happen over the course of time is in New York City, some of the drummers for the pit bands started to accumulate their own equipment and storing it off out on the island in a storage place, and then started renting to the shows themselves. Huh. So they weren't necessarily going to Barry. But Barry still had... He was the world percussion expert there, and I used to go in the shop and he'd say, Barry had things in there that I didn't even know how to pronounce the word, what the name of what they were, never mind how to play them. He had all manner of crazy stuff. Anything you could think of, he had it for world percussion, from didgeridoo things, crazy rain sticks, rope drums, all sorts of world percussion stuff that I never even heard of. It was crazy. So he was a real specialist in that type of thing. Barry's shop, he kept going for a few more years, and I think it was about, I think we had been there about 3 years, so maybe around 2011 or so. That was when Barry decided to retire. He'd been doing it for probably over 30 years, so he decided to retire, and his shop closed at that point in time. But he had a good shop. Good guy, and he held the fort down for a lot of years.
Interesting. Yeah, neither of our shops have really been into too much renting. They do a little bit in New York, I know, but it's not like a...
We do some. It's hard to do it robustly because there's so much. There's just so many different things and so many different types of instruments across so many different world cultures that it's virtually impossible to stock
people probably
everything.
Come
we don't
to
have
us.
Any room.
If they're looking for an American vintage kit, pretty much that's
right,
what we
have. We'll have certain things that make sense. So we'll have bongos, we'll have some congas, we'll have some shakers, some of the what I'll call more standard world percussion type items. But anything that's exotic and esoteric, we just don't
sure.
do it. But then should we move on to?
The last shop, the classic New York shop that we're going to talk about here is Nodar Rode.
Yeah, Nodar. Nodar has been around for a long time.
A lot of you know that name, probably.
Yes. Nodar's still around. He's operating, I think he's in New Jersey now. But Nodar, his specialty, really more so than selling drums, was he did work on drums. He did a lot of work. So people would bring him drums where bearing edges were kind of shot, and he would true up the bearing edges. But he would also, if people had a set, maybe they had a set of 50s Ludwig drums with mahogany poplar, mahogany shells, and rounded edges. But maybe they wanted something that projected a little more, but they still wanted the mahogany. So Nodar would cut the edges maybe to 45s or whatever. So Nodar did a lot of work like that, which was important because people needed repair work done. Part of what we talked earlier about Joe Cusatis' shop, Modern Drum Shop, they also did repair work. And as a matter of fact, Willie Martinez, who works for us now in New York City, Willie was the repair person for Joe at Modern Drum Shop.
Willie's a good guy.
For many, many, many years. And Willie's arguably the finest repair person in New York City, yeah. Period, end of story.
He's a fantastic job.
He's great. But again, Nodar did that kind of work. He did repairs, things along those lines. So that was important. So if you fast forward all of that and you go to, well, what's it like today? Today, what you basically have in Manhattan is Guitar Center, the Sam Ash stores, and us. So we are, I think we are pretty much the only independent drum shop left in New York City. And as I joked about once before, people say, you're the only ones. And I say, yeah, we're the only ones dumb enough to be here paying these rents and everything else. But to us, it's very important. I myself was inspired by the shops that we talked about here, especially Frank Ippolito's. That was a huge inspiration on me. And for us to be able to open up in New York in 2008 and to still be there now in 2020, it's a long run. And we're really proud of that, and we're proud to be able to serve that community and keep that independent drum shop vibe alive. I just cannot imagine Manhattan without an independent drum shop. Just doesn't seem like it could. Doesn't seem right.
I was lucky enough to see Nodar's shop, and I remember that. You probably brought me there, and then we went to Arnie Lang's place as well.
Yeah, Arnie.
Not a shop, but.
Yeah, but I should mention Arnie. Arnie as well. Arnie Lang's a good friend. retired from the New York Philharmonic, but percussionist for many, many years. And Arnie is best known for building replicas of the Billy Gladstone snare drums that are marketed as Lang Gladstone drums. And we have built many of those drums. Arnie has built many of those drums for me with Craviato shells. So we have done Lang Gladstone with Craviato shells. And I won't go into detail here, but the beauty of the Gladstone drum is the Gladstone drum was a unique device created by Billy Gladstone, and it uses three-way tuning, and you can tune everything from the top. You can tune the top head from the top. The key has a different side that attaches, and you can tune the bottom head from the top, and you get the third key that attaches to both pieces that allows you to basically tune the top and bottom together
simultaneously. Yeah.
And Billy invented a very simple throw-off, a very detailed tone control, and these are all things that he developed and built. And for a while, they marketed some drums under the Gretsch name as Gretsch Gladstone, but then Billy made the famous Billy Gladstone snares out of his apartment in New York City, built about 50-some drums, and we have had the privilege of selling about 12 of the 50 drums.
We might even do a separate
one of these. And we probably will do a separate one on this where we can talk to you about this.
And we've done a couple calfskin head videos, and that's really what that was designed for.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a quick note there.
And it's a wonderful instrument, incredible instrument, highly, highly collectible as a player instrument as well as a collector instrument. But you're talking some of the rarest ones are, pushing in the $26,000 to $28,000 range for the snare drum.
Yeah.
But Arnie, sidetrack there a little bit. Arnie Lang had an original Gladstone snare drum, which he still has, and Arnie has been making very, very faithful replicas of those Gladstone drums for many years. So hats off to Arnie for that. He's still doing it to this day, even though Arnie's getting up there in years, but he's still doing it. He still cranks them out, so I give him credit for that. But yeah. So I would call him another independent in the New York area.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He came to the Chicago Drum Show 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was great fun.
It's always good to see him. So that covers what I consider to be the the great independent drum shops in New York City that all, to some degree, varying degrees, but especially Frank Ippolito's, were inspiring to us, and that's the reason why we're there today and why we're going to be there in the future.
For sure. And then later on, we'll do one that focuses on the Chicago drum shops, because that, yes, that's a whole nother episode there.
Yes, it is.
So, yeah, thanks for listening to everybody, and check us out. At the beginning there, I had all of our various social media outlets, and I'll have that in the description as well.
Great.
So, yeah, that's all.
Thank you, everybody.